We're excited that we've picked up a bunch of listeners all over the world, including Japan, Ireland, Sweden, and even the Congo. Horror is truly a global village of the damned. Thanks a bunch, everyone. You might have seen the announcement on Dread Central, Daily Dead, or Shock Till You Drop that our book, Death by Umbrella, The 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, is out. It features a foreword written by Lloyd Kaufman of Troma and chronicles our favorite kills and our favorite weapons, covering indie horror to mainstream slashers and beyond. We're happy to report that the digital version of the book has now been added to Amazon.com, where you can also find the soft and hardcover editions. On with the show.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? All right!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait, there's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
Yeah, I don't mean to keep harping, but the name The Turtle Club, you know, it's just a name. I think you're taking it a little bit too literally.
Turtle?
May I help you? Are you a member of The Turtle Club?
Well, not exactly.
Not exactly, but am I not turtly enough for The Turtle Club?
Is he okay?
He's fine.
He's fine, Turtle.
Turtle? He's dreamt of this place ever since he was a child.
Turtle!
Do you think we can go in for a moment? We'll be out in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Please.
All right.
Turtle!
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 104. Dana Carvey in 2002's Master of Disguise.
Oh, Yves. Master of Disguise. Okay, so why are we doing Master of Disguise in the Really Awful Movies podcast? I mean, we talk about genre film, predominantly horror. Horror comes in all shapes and sizes, and certain things are not horror, but are rather horrific. Master of Disguise is horrific. Why are we talking about this movie? Well, a ways back, we talked to our good friend Scott Drebbit from The Daily Dead, and we were talking about fandom today and how it's either the best movie of all time or the worst movie of all time. And Scott just offhandedly said, come on, guys, the worst movie of all time, have you seen The Master of Disguise? And I had never seen The Master of Disguise, so it kind of jogged my memory. Oh, yeah, I remember those stupid commercials, you know, turtle, turtle. And I said, well, hey, you know, we're the Really Awful Movies podcast. Would you like to delve into the worst of the worst sometimes? And at the same token, we're masochists. So, shit, let's do The Master of Disguise.
And now, you did mention how the turtle jogged your memory, because mm-hmm. It's starting to flood back to me like PTSD in a way here. The turtle bit, mm-hmm. Was that from like the Turtles chocolate, the jingle, like Turtles
no, I don't think so. It was just nothing to do with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, or I mean, there's a lot of lame references in this movie, but this is some character that Dana Carvey in his bottomless well of comedic characters just mm-hmm. came up with, and we'll talk a little about Dana Carvey in a moment or two.
Yeah, but this from the wellspring of the Saturday Night Live
character to movie factory, mm-hmm. and there was the Will Ferrell, I forget his sidekick in the nightclub movie. The name is
Chris Kattan.
And what was that thing called?
Night
at the Roxbury. Mm-hmm. Wayne's World goes on.
Well, I mean, say we will about SNL. You know, it's had its good years. It's had its bad years. In the earliest days, it was revolutionary. It was groundbreaking. You know, not ready for primetime players. Then it went through its lean years. Then it went through revitalization in the 80s. Then in the early 90s. Then it's lean years again. I haven't watched the show in years. I did watch maybe 20 minutes of an episode that was hosted by Chris Hemsworth maybe about 3 months ago, and I couldn't make it through past the second sketch.
Yeah, SNL. I've dipped into it on occasion with Bill Hader and the odd one of the more current rosters, but I can never, and Kenan Thompson, who actually has a bit part here, but this is the current incarnation I can't take. But I don't exactly have, I don't look at the past with rose-colored glasses either, because I don't think it was very good ever, other than a bit of Bill Murray and some of the really good characters. But when I much preferred Kids in the Hall and the more edgy comedy.
Well,
but
I mean, the Kids in the Hall was phenomenal. I will not take that away from you. However,
or SCTV,
Monty Python. But there was a period in my life where I will say I was obsessed with Saturday Night Live. If I was home on Saturdays, which was most Saturdays, I watched it. If I went out, which was rare, I would tape it. Mm-hmm. And I would watch it the next day. I loved it. And I would go to school on Monday, and I'd be quoting the episodes, and I'd be, you know, imitating certain characters. Some of those characters were played by Deanna Carvey. And over the years, when you look at the alumni of Saturday Night Live, I mean, there have been many bona fide movie stars. And you mentioned Will Ferrell, but I mean, come on, go right from the beginning. You got your Chevy Chase, you got your Dan Aykroyd,
your Bill Belushi's Murray, and everybody,
your Belushi's, you got your Eddie Murphy's, you got your Billy Crystal's,
and perennial host Steve Martin. That broke him, but yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and then Mike Myers, mm-hmm. and I mean, you know, Adam Sandler was huge for a while, and you know, now he's sort of become anathema to comedy, but you know, but the fact is, SNL, Chris Farley, I mean, it's produced so many successful comedians that transcended the show and became successful movie stars. Dana Carvey, I will argue, was one of the funnier cast members in the 80s, along with perhaps, well, I mean, you can't discount Phil Hartman. I mean, he was an incredible asset to that show. I mean, he was just your everyman character that could always, I mean, he never stood out per se, but he was always so integral to whatever sketch he was in. Of course, when Mike Myers came on the scene, he was just unbelievable.
Yeah,
of course,
with Dieter and everything, just phenomenal, sly, mm-hmm. Subtle. You know, pop culture characters that really went, I think, over the heads of a lot of people too. In that context,
straight out of Scarberia, Mike Myers, Toronto,
good Toronto boy.
He would ply his trade on City TV on Speaker's Corner. He'd be doing Wayne, you know, the early gestation of Wayne.
Yeah, Speaker's Corner, just a vox pop video show where you'd put in some money and record a 1 minute little broadcast. Presaged all that reality show stuff. Is really interesting.
But, I mean, since we're talking about Saturday Night Live, like, I'll tell you why I was obsessed with Saturday Night Live, why I love the show so much. As a child, as I'm sure you had as well, I had a bedtime. It was I think it was sort of draconian. I mean, you know, it was rather early. Raised by a single mother. She was pretty strict. And, yeah, I think my bedtime was like 9 o'clock when I was young. And maybe 10 o'clock on the weekends. Mm-hmm. Maybe. If I had, like, friends sleeping over or something. Now, when I would stay with my father, he was a little bit more lenient, and he would let me stay up a bit later. But the only time I could ever stay up past, say, 11 o'clock was when Saturday Night's Main Event was on. He would let me stay up. That would, you know, every so often preempt Saturday Night Live. And, you know, I can go on and on about some of the incredible memories of staying up late.
That's where I would set my alarm, because I was, like you, I had a bedtime, let's say 10 or 11, set my alarm for 11:30, go downstairs and watch Saturday Night's Main Event, before the WWE product became extremely diluted and just populated with steroid heads, and before all the wrestlers really looked the same. Back in the era when xenophobia and sexism was really in, and sadly those days are long gone.
Well, I mean, Saturday Night's Main Event, I mean, I watched the Mega Powers explode, you know, the Randy Savage and Hulk Hogan when they were a tag team, and all of a sudden they're fighting over Elizabeth and everything.
Yes.
And, you know, Elizabeth! Anyway, whatever. We're not talking about that. We're talking about Saturday Night Live. So, I don't know. Maybe I was about 9 years old, 10 years old. I woke up from my slumber. It was a Saturday. It was actually Sunday. It was Sunday morning. It was after midnight. And I ever so surreptitiously crept downstairs so as not to wake my mother, and I turned on the TV, and it happened to be on the channel that Saturday Live was playing. And I recall it was a sketch with, it could have been very well be that very famous sketch, because I remember there being vampires in it. And there was that sketch with James Woods, and he was playing a vampire. Okay. And every time he would, before he would suck someone's blood, he would go, "Are you monogamous?" Because this was the 80s.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Good AIDS joke is always timeless.
And I was just transfixed because, number one, there was something clandestine about it. I was doing something I was not allowed to do, which was stay up late. I was watching a show with adult humor, so that was the second reason. And just the fact that it was live, this made it, I don't know, there's something very unique about it. Now, not too long afterwards, my mother got rather lax on my bedtime. They said, you know what, you can go to bed whenever you want. So at that point, Saturday Night Live was appointment viewing for me. And this was when Dana Carvey, John Lovett, Phil Hartman, Jan Hooks,
Chris Rock, even.
Well, that was maybe later, yes. Yeah. Kevin Nealon, who was in this one, and he's the worst SNL cast member of all time. But anyhow, Saturday Night Live, from that point straight on until I would say maybe just before 2000, you know, maybe up until 1999, I was a dedicated SNL watcher. And as I said before, if I didn't watch the show, if I wasn't home, I would tape the show. And I watched it go up and down a bit, but I was dedicated. And then there came a point where I was like, you know what, it's just not worth my time anymore. It's not funny. Every so often, you know, something would go viral, like Dick in a Box or something, Andy Samberg. Or
yeah, Norm MacDonald and OJ and on the anchor desk.
Well, that was I was still watching stuff. At that point. Yeah, but I mean, I'm talking about after I stopped watching it, those, you know, digital shorts would go viral and I would watch it. But I was no longer a regular SNL viewer. But, you know, throughout this time, I mean, they'd be churning out movies based on SNL characters, some way more successful than others. Knight of the Roxbury was not that successful. Tim Meadows, the ladies' man, was not that successful. But Wayne's World was huge. Mm-hmm. And of course, Dana Carvey was Garth. So we're doing this podcast on Master of Disguise because of Scott Drevet, because he mentioned that...
Lay the blame at his feet.
Yeah, exactly. One of the worst movies ever seen.
It really is. I have to concur there.
And also because, you know, it gives us a chance to talk about SNL and so on and so forth. But I don't know. You know, Dana Carvey was... He was a go-to guy. He was hilarious on Saturday Night Live. He so many memorable characters. I'm talking about the church lady. I'm talking about Hans and Franz. You know, we are here to pump you up.
Yeah, and then they're back in a recent incarnation for plugging some sort of insurance product or something. I know because the quarterback from the Green Bay Packers does a thing with them, and him and Kevin Nealon are back, and it still works. So they're pitching some sort of product, and it's still hilarious.
There was also the...
It's timeless.
Of course, you know, he was known for his George Bush imitation.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be prudent at this end. At this juncture. Dana Carvey was... hilarious. When I would see him on talk shows, he would crack me up. When I would, he had his own show.
Yeah.
On prime time, the Dana Carvey Show.
So did Magic Johnson. The you know.
Well, yeah, but this was barely, a talk show. This was a comedy show.
Comprehensible basketball player.
It was subversive. It didn't last long. I remember there was one sketch where he was playing Bill Clinton with like 12 nipples on each side of his body. It was, I don't know, bizarre. But the reality is, I had never seen Master of Disguise. I remember the trailers.
Which just goes to show how dependent he was on ensemble casting, because here he's called upon to carry the freight by himself, and but he doesn't have the sass or the wit of a Mike Myers to be able to carry the day. He's just sort of left flopping to his own devices, and it seems like almost a vanity piece because no one checked him to say this is too much. Mm-hmm. So all of these characters, every one of his castmates were just enablers. Well, he went through one unfunny impression after another. And he was always spot on with all his impressions. But this one, he does a snake charmer. He does, okay, the turtle was great, but he reprises George Bush.
But this is now
George W. Bush. Yeah. And I guess a fat English gentleman character of questionable provenance, and all these people were not good, and his impressions were not good. This is what he was known for.
He did a version of Al Pacino, a Scarface Escalino, not good. He did a Quint character from Jaws,
Yeah,
not good. But even just like, you know, your basic ethnic accents, like you said, you mentioned a snake charmer, Indian snake charmer.
No Peter Sellers.
Peter Sellers would be rolling over in his grave.
Yeah.
I mean, it was
party num num. Yeah,
it was awful. And then beyond that, he's impersonating like a cow pie, like a piece of manure. He's impersonating like the filling of cherry pie. Ridiculous. Okay, we should talk a little bit about the plot of this movie.
Yeah, I guess he plays Pistachio Disguiso.
Disguisee,
yeah, who comes from a long line of Impressionists going back to Palermo, Sicily. And which is ironic as well, because we didn't mention the worst impression he does throughout this, which is an Italian accent.
Yeah. Well, he's not doing any sort of disguise. He's just playing some Italian character.
Yeah, very, very badly. And this thing seems to be set on maybe like the Gilmore Girls WB lot. Like, this is the worst Potemkin village going. This is so cheap. This is sitcom, Law & Order SVU, New York streetscape, where it just looks like cardboard. Mm-hmm. And they're wandering around this. And it also has the sort of I don't know if you got this, a Dick Tracy aesthetic at times, too. It has a very weird look to it. At times, and it doesn't know what it wants to be. It's ostensibly a kids' movie, but it has references that would go over the heads of most kids, and it makes you wonder at whom this was directed. And it's just a complete mess. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Pistachio Disguisee, as I've been corrected, he comes from several generations of Impressionists.
Well, not only Impressionists, but Masters of Disguise. The lineage of it all is that, you know, from time immemorial, apparently, because at one point, you know, they had to, Abraham Lincoln was delivering a speech, and they had to substitute with their impression of Abraham Lincoln. And
No one was here to emancipate us from this shitty movie, but
he gets the stage too. I like the movie. And it's
he
like,
break dances as Abe Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable.
So they're Masters of Disguise / secret agents. And his father, when we're first introduced, it's Bo Derek. And he's running away from some sort of nefarious villain. And
it turns out it's Bo Derek is a disguise, and it's his dad under all that dreadlock makeup from whatever shitty movie that was.
Well, but that was real Bo Derek. Yeah,
it was, but Ten.
Playing the characters he played in Ten.
But then the Bo Derek dreads and mask comes off, and it turns out to be
James Brolin. Yeah. And he's doing some voiceover, and he's saying, you know, this life, I don't want it for my son. So there's a flashback of little Pistachio Disguisee, and he's got this talent for mimicry. He can mimic, but he doesn't know, you know, what the lineage is of the Disguisee family.
Yeah.
His parents, his family, played, of course, by the very Italian James Brolin and Edie McClurg.
Mm.
Edie McClurg was in a whole bunch of 80s sitcoms.
Yeah.
None that come to mind. They operate some Italian restaurant. And
complete with like the Yasser Arafat garb tablecloths. And that's sort of your standard, typical, run-of-the-mill Olive Garden-type restaurant. Mm. Speaks to the authenticity with which they approach Italian culture with the mimicry and the restaurants. Ugh.
And Disguisee works as a waiter. And anyway,
there's endless set pieces of trip waiter gags and spaghetti going flying. And
so James Brolin, there's one person that did an Italian accent more poorly than David Carver. It was James Brolin. But, you know, he has a nemesis. His old archenemy, Devlin Bowman, played by a somewhat unrecognizable Brent Spiner.
From Data from Star Trek.
Yeah. And Brent Spiner is still holding a grudge from that Bo Derek incident, and he kidnaps Mama and Papa.
In order to use this guy's disguise abilities in order to steal great works of art and sell them on the black market.
Great works of art, but like the Constitution, the Liberty Bell.
Yeah, everything.
Like,
yeah.
Rare items, you know? Mm-hmm.
Rare items.
Yeah. And so. Point. I mean, I don't know. The beginning of this movie, I kind of thought, hey, it's mildly amusing. And there was this one scene where then Pistachio comes home after they kidnap the mama and the papa, and he notices that the home has been vandalized, ransacked.
Yeah.
He calls the police and goes, they ransacked my home. It's full of ransackery. And for some reason, I found that funny. Well, that was about the only
laugh
I had in the entire movie. Because before you know it, we see Pistachio in a sort of like a very clumsy homage to The Exorcist, which could go way over the head of the kids watching this movie.
Yeah, complete with tubular bells and the silhouetted form of this fedorated figure a la
Max von Sydow.
Yeah,
and it's Pistachio's grandfather who tells him about his lineage and his talent and
trains him as a master of disguise and tells him about this ridiculous MacGuffin called Energico, which has to harness in order to be, you know, to fulfill his destiny of as a master of disguise. Yeah. And he gets an assistant, a very attractive assistant, and the whole thing is basically, you know, I have to foil the nefarious plot of
and rescue Roman his dad.
Rescue dad. Meanwhile, dad is imitating such faded. I mean, this came out in 2002, right? So I guess at the time they were relevant, but you know, Jessica Simpson.
Yes, Michael, pop sensation of a decade ago.
A reality show, you know,
staple.
At one point, I got up for a bathroom break, and you said, oh, they just had Michael Johnson as a cameo.
Yeah, a figure I had not thought about in years and years. Formerly the world's fastest man before Usain Bolt ran away with the title, literally and figuratively. Yeah, Michael Johnson, medalist. Mm-hmm. He briefly was in a relay race with the Constitution. That's what you missed when you went to the bathroom again. Nothing much there.
Then Governor Jesse Ventura.
Yeah, who plays himself.
Yeah.
In some sort of ploy to steal the Liberty Bell out of wherever it's held in Philadelphia. I should know this because I saw it, but whatever. And what else?
But all this is punctuated by just set pieces of Dana Carvey.
Excuses, I would say, yeah. To do his mediocre impressions.
Donning disguises. And
I got to say, impressions. I know these are disguises, not impressions. And it's impressions are a subset of disguises. Mm-hmm. Impression comedy, I think, is the absolute worst. I cannot stand it. Maybe ventriloquism is lower on the hierarchy of entertainment. Yeah. But good God, mimicry. It has to be paired with something else. You can't, there has to be, it has to be a vehicle for something else. Mm. You can't just do, and that's what has brought SNL to its knees recently, because they've relied so much upon mimicry and not the quality of their writing. So mm-hmm. they just rely on someone doing Alex Trebek, and then they rehash the same Jeopardy game show sketch over and over and over again, but mm-hmm. not without the proper writing to back it up. But
again, what I don't understand is that on SNL, Dana Carvey was a talented mimic. The guy could do characters. He could imitate, you know, whomever
was. Yeah, with a huge team of writers and under the direction of Lorne Michaels to make sure it was good. And this guy, I don't know, did he write this thing? We haven't really researched it. We don't know who else was behind this that enabled this vanity piece.
It was produced by Happy Gilmore Productions, which is
Adam Sandler's. Yeah.
But I mean, I want to ask you, we love comedy. You're not a big fan of mimicry. I don't mind a talented impressionist. Rich Little was awful. All he could do was Ronald Reagan. But we like comedy. I mean, we like to laugh. I mean, man, some of our favorite movies are comedies. This is Spinal Tap, Monty mm-hmm. Python's Life of Brian, etc.
Yeah.
Comedy is very interesting because what is funny is subjective. You know, what one person finds absolutely side-splitting, another person will be like, I just don't get it. It's not funny to me. And having said that, you know, some comedians that people love, for example, Jim Carrey. I can't stand the guy.
Yeah, people have the same reaction. One of my favorites, Ricky Gervais from The Office.
We
love him. He's very polarizing to some.
Mm-hmm. But when it comes to a comedy movie, and this is the question. This is a very difficult question to answer because comedy is so subjective. But I'm going to ask you, what makes a comedy successful? What is funny?
Okay, I would say something this completely lacks, which is a certain heartlessness and callousness. Because I like dark black humor, mm-hmm. the more offensive the better. I like Jimmy Carr, a UK comedian. I like the recurring suicide motifs in Groundhog Day. Mm. I thought it was absolutely hilarious to have that edge. This thing had no edge at all. Mm-hmm. And that's why I go back to my question earlier about to whom was this directed.
But see, I'm a huge fan of Charlie Chaplin. I love the man. I love his...
Oh, I love the Marx Brothers, too. And we should say he did a terrible impression of Groucho Marx.
He did, yeah. Now, with the genius of the Little Tramp, Charlie Chaplin, there was something else going on there, and that was poignancy.
It was sweetness, yeah. Underneath,
that's the thing that they say about
underneath comedians. The buffoonery has to. This is one thing Will Ferrell really pulls off. Mm-hmm. He's a terrific dramatic actor, and for all his over the top, let's say sexism of the Ron Burgundy character, underneath you root for him, even though he's morally reprehensible. He's a sweet guy,
right?
And this, no.
Yeah, and so that's the whole thing. Like, I mean, so it's, you know, there's a whole, you know, the Tears of a Clown. I mean, it's not just a Smokey Robinson song. They say that, you know, the only, I'm making you laugh, because if I'm not going to make you laugh, I would cry instead.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Little Tramp, all those women, there was something so sad, poignant, sweet. There was some pathos going on. So, yeah, you either got to have that poignancy or you got to have that edge, right?
That's weird you bring up Jim Carrey, because I would argue that the same problems that befall him and his vehicles are the ones that plague Carrey here. He needs an ensemble to rein him in a way. I don't care for any Jim Carrey movies. I would say there's, well, maybe a couple are halfway decent.
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yeah, that was kind of good. Yeah,
or very different. Yeah,
yeah, or the Truman Show, sort of. Not really a comedy, but he's a capable dramatic actor. But I don't find his facial histrionics particularly compelling. Mm-hmm. And but on as a sketch performer, he was beyond the pale. Just he was outstanding with the Wayans brothers.
On In Living Color, yeah. I admit he was incredible. Fire Marshal Bill,
Rocky as well, just unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
He was, I know everyone can do Rocky. I've done it myself. I don't know if I can do it with all my wine and Adrian. You know, I can sort of do it. I'm wearing a tie right now, so maybe. But a lot of hack impressionists can do Clint Eastwood. You know, it's a 44 Magnum. You blow your head clean off. That kind of thing. Okay, it's hackery.
Sounded a little more Seagal to me.
Yeah, and again, I don't know. It's no one was reining in Carvey here. He didn't have any foil. He didn't have the much more talented wit of Mike Myers. He's just a pop culture. Yeah. Blender, we just churned all that stuff together, spat it out.
And some will argue that, I mean, Mike Myers sort of went off the rails with the Love Guru,
which I actually
kind of enjoyed. I thought it was funny.
I thought it wasn't nearly as bad. It was bad, but I didn't think it was. It had its moments. It was kind of fun at times.
I mean, it wasn't a masterpiece by any means, but it wasn't. It didn't deserve the critical evisceration that it got, and it pretty much killed his career as a live-action comedian. Well, maybe that and Cat in the Hat, because now he's pretty much known just for doing the voice of Shrek.
And documentaries. Yeah.
He did the documentary on his manager, Chef Gordon.
Yes, which we reviewed on our site, and it was really amazing, but he hasn't gone back to his comedic days, other than maybe making us laugh with his ridiculous toupees he keeps trotting out in. Like, have you seen that? His latest giant gray pompadour.
I
don't think that man has had hair in a decade. It's really ridiculous. I only know
what you just said right now is anything in that entire 80 minutes of Master of Disguise.
It's only because my cousin pointed this out on Facebook when our current Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was being feted at the White House by Obama and Michelle Obama, that a bunch of Canadian celebrities were in attendance, on Capitol Hill and everything.
And that's not White House anymore, Canadian celebrities.
Yeah, we actually have Canadian celebrities now. And he was one of them, and my God, that rug, it just looked unbelievable. And there actually is a toupee joke in this movie, if I'm not mistaken, where this art collector has a bunch of rare, priceless items. In his collection, there's the landing module from whatever Apollo mission went on to the, I forget which number landed on the moon, and they actually had the hairpiece that Bruce Willis wore in some movies. This is some dig at
Bruce
Willis
hairpiece from so Die cheap, Hard 2. Like, it was just shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah,
it was. Yeah, there was no. So in other words, there was no edge, there was no poignancy,
no pathos,
and there was no wit, and there was no
slyness, no transcendence.
Because that's another thing that makes something funny.
No Sacha Baron Cohen transcendence or edge. There's nothing.
Satire is funny. You know, when you could take something inherently ridiculous and really just sink your claws into it. I'm talking about, like, for example, Borat and making fun of the xenophobia and the fear of foreigners and whatnot, and, you know, anti-Semitism and whatnot. And just, if you could, like, satirize something, or if you could, you know, or...
Or Dr. Strangelove or something. Yeah,
yeah, so exactly.
No fighting in the war room and that. Just really poignant, amazing scenes.
Or if you're just a wonderful observationist for, like, Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah, or Woody Allen. Yeah.
Or Woody Allen or Lenny Bruce. I mean...
Well, one of my favorite psych gags of all time, Take the Money and Run. Woody Allen, he's flashing back.
This is Woody Allen. He was still funny.
Yes, true. He's flashing back to his high school band, and they're doing a performance on the street, and he's playing the cello, and they're marching, and he's trying to run along with his cello, of course. You know, don't have to explain a cello joke, but hilarious. Or in the same movie where the bank tellers can't read his hold-up note. Like, hilarious stuff. It doesn't need to be so smart that you have to go to have earned your doctorate at Cambridge to understand it.
It's just funny because,
like, I appreciate a Dumb and Dumber. I don't mind
slapstick.
Yeah, it's your Buster Keatons and as you mentioned before, yeah, your Chaplins and whatnot. There's all different types of comedy, and Marx Brothers holds up just as well today.
It's funny because you know, Woody Allen. I mean, we both love Woody Allen, and a lot of people will, you know, demarcate his career. You know, the funny Woody Allen.
Pre-molestation post?
No, no. I'm talking about the funny Woody Allen. That was sort of like the funny slapstick Woody of like Bananas and Sleeper and Take the Money and Run. And then after Annie Hall, he started doing stuff like, you know, Manhattan and, you know, on and on. And, you know, the more serious Woody. But
even those, like Hannah and her sisters, were just hilariously funny and serious.
But it reminds me of
One of my favorites, Crimes and Misdemeanors, which is incredibly dark, and Martin Landau, and yet incredibly funny and poignant.
And also very philosophical. That's another thing Woody Allen brought to his comedy. But it reminds me, because, I mean, the thing about Woody Allen, I mean, he always represented sort of like, you know, the urbane, you know, like sophisticated New Yorker, kind of like, you know, well-to-do, etc. So, and because of that, it was always at the mark of sophistication was Woody Allen. It reminds me of my favorite scenes in The Simpsons when they're holding a dinner party and Marge wanted to sort of impress Hibbert and the Van Houtens, etc. Because, you know, Homer was embarrassing them and stuff. And at one point there was like this, you know, this pregnant pause, and she's like, she had to say something. And she goes, "So, has anybody here seen the new Woodsy Allen movie?"
Oh, yes. And then Ned Flanders says, I never cared for that little nervous fellow who's always in them.
Yeah, exactly. I like his movies. I never cared for that little nervous fellow in them. That was great.
But to return to this and to curb your yammering skull cave, as one of the lines to quote from this movie. My God. Just a horror show. Set piece. After set piece,
they just lands with a terrible thud. And you know what? You just mentioned the word curb.
Yeah.
Curb your enthusiasm. That's another element of comedy. Humiliation.
Yes. Yeah.
When somebody...
This is a different kind of humiliation.
This is just somebody who's strong, you know, who is humiliating himself unbeknownst. But when somebody, like, for example, Larry David, I mean, this is a guy that routinely is just humiliated again and again and again, but at the same time he's above it all.
Yeah,
he thinks he's always in the right, you know what I mean? That's why that character works so well.
Yeah,
Curb is incredible. This is not.
No,
this is not. This is just like everything lands with a dull thud, and I just imagine seeing this in the cinemas, and there's nothing more depressing, because I've experienced it, than sitting in a cinema for a comedy movie with a full audience, and there's no one laugh in the entire movie.
It's interesting when something lands with a thud. Like the worst movies are ones that try to be funny and aren't. Like, I would accept the worst horror films, because it really, they're not aiming too high. Scares are not too hard to come by. Even the worst hack can deliver one scare. This thing had nary a laugh in 80 minutes. We barely got through this thing.
It was interminable.
Not a single laugh the whole way through. I don't know.
But ultimately, I mean, comedy is subjective, and there could be people out there that think that this is the height of hilarity.
Well, when I was a budding Pauline Kael or a Gene Siskel or something, I remember the time when my critical faculties were well enough developed that I could discern what was shit comedy and what wasn't. I loved the first Police Academy movie. And then as they started, which was by no means...
I love it too.
It's by no means Sleepers or Groundhog Day or Anchorman or anything. It has very few laughs. But by the time it got up into the sequels, I said, you know what? This isn't funny anymore. My friends were still saying, oh, this is uproarious, because the black guy who could do all the impressions. At that point, it was... No more, no mas. I can't take this.
But there's another thing.
Third or fourth, I think, is Police Academy. At some point, I got old enough to realize, holy crap, is this awful.
Right. But you got to remember, too, with Police Academy, I mean, the first movie and the second were R-rated movies. And by the time they got to, like, number 9, like, you know, Miami Beach or whatever, or Russia or what have you. I mean, they're rated G, you know?
Yeah.
They just became completely defanged and, you know, dumbed down.
Yeah, defrocked and D whatever.
Going back, I mean, when I think of the 80s, I think of some of my favorite comedies. I adore Summer School. Hmm. Mark Harmon. Have you seen that one?
No.
Oh, my God. You have to see it. Just for Chainsaw Dave alone, okay? You're a horror fan? You love Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Summer School? Mark Harmon? Chainsaw and Dave. That's all I'm going to say. Our listeners that know about Summer School, they know what I'm talking about. That was great. Revenge of the Nerds.
Oh, for sure.
That was great.
Yeah. Which we referenced in the last podcast for all the full frontal female nudity in Hellhole. We got Bush.
A lot of...
Or was that? That might have been Porky's. No, that was Revenge of the Nerds. Oh, Porky's another one, yeah.
A lot of Steve Martin stuff. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
The Jerk, yeah.
The Jerk. Oh, my God, The Jerk is
hilarious. Well, the Dirty Rotten Scoundrels had the incredible Michael Caine, so... Yep.
Mm-hmm. Planes, Trains, Automobiles.
Amazing.
Amazing stuff. This is great. I mean, this is great comedy.
Yeah, your Ghostbusters from the time you... Your mid to late 80s and 90s. And from the same period, this thing just fell with such a thud. And it made me kind of depressed.
It was depressing for me. It was a thoroughly depressing experience. I perked up just a little bit during the turtle scene because it was kind of surreal. And I do like surreal comedy. But that was just... other than that, this...
And we tried to endure as you were holding your temples there from a headache induced in part by the wine and in large majority to Master of Disguise. The outtakes toward the end. There's nothing worse than outtakes for an unfunny movie. And you could see his co-stars humoring him while he goes through. Again, I mentioned the Groucho Marx. I would not join any club that would have me as a member or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, I love Groucho Marx. And this, it just sank so badly. And he was doing, I guess he did martial arts characters too, like sort of a Bruce Lee type.
Yeah, making fun of the fake dubbing and stuff. Yeah, just low-hanging fruit. Yeah. Just going after the most obvious targets.
Yeah, it made me sadsies. Yeah, I was I'm depressed now.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what, it is sad because Dana Carvey, I mean, the man was talented on SNL, and he never really broke through as a movie star. He had to play second fiddle to Mike Myers in the Wayne's World movies, which, by the way, I thought the second one was pretty shitty. The first one was was a lot of fun, but the second one sucked. This, I think, killed his career. He did not really star in a movie since. He had some health problems as well, but all the same, I'm sure he probably thought this could have been a franchise. This could have been like the next great, you know, and Peter Sellers-esque character that would have been.
And impressionists also, like your Rich Littles and these types, they tend not to update their material. So his brand of comedy has not changed with the times. Mm-hmm. He's not going out there to go after the latest celeb and do a great lampooning that would keep him in the good graces of kids. So he's just mired in this sort of miasma of George Bush II, and it's so far removed from any there's people born in the, whatever, the 90s and whatnot, they have just no frame of reference to whatever clips of Ronald Reagan. It's just so far detached. The guy has not kept up with the Joneses of comedy. He's just...
Are you referring to Rich Little or Dana Carvey right now?
Both. Most impressionists for sure, and Kevin Pollak is another guy. He does really good Kiss impressions. He does pretty good William Shatner. Mm-hmm. But these guys, they're not current.
Well, we have that Canadian guy, André Philippe Gagnon.
Another one. If you're going to be doing Mick Jagger in that, you got to do Sam Smith. You got to do someone who's been relevant on the charts in the last 2 to 3 years.
Right.
Or else you're just doomed. Mm-hmm. And it's just sad.
Right. So I don't know, this is like maybe one of the most depressing episodes I've ever offered. It's ironic that an episode about comedy has become the most depressing episode
we've ever offered. Our first intentional comedy of our podcast. But this did have the same sort of dull thud as a Battlefield Earth. Mm-hmm. We're sitting here dumbfounded, just stupefied, looking at this going like, who is responsible for this? There's no one behind the scenes, no one who sunk money into this to pull someone aside and say, this is not working from the first frame to the last and beyond the last with the, my God, the outtakes, the interminable credits rolling at the end. It just, wow.
So what's our takeaway from this? Because, I mean,
what is our takeaway? For every Norm MacDonald and Tina Fey and Will Ferrell and Jim Belushi Okay, wrong Belushi. Did I pick the wrong Belushi?
Yes,
you did. Yeah, okay.
John Belushi.
The deceased Belushi, sorry. My apologies. Yeah, it's a huge difference. Yeah, for your Steve Martin and your Jan Hooks. And my God, it's just brutal. You have to develop a story around the character. You can't just do your voices. And that's what Wayne's World did so successfully. Anyway, they had so much more to start with their pop culture references within the context of their sketch. So they didn't need so much to build around it. But this thing really sagged in the middle, the beginning, and the end.
Say what you will about Wayne's World. I mean, to this day, you cannot listen to Bohemian Rhapsody the same day ever since that movie hit multiplexes. Because that was just an iconic scene of comedy.
Yeah, among
the
many.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess the takeaway is that we liked, you know, we're interesting in the sense that a lot of movies that people just eviscerate and destroy, we can find the silver lining. We like them, you know? This one, there was no silver lining. Yeah. This was just unfunny, sad, and, you know, especially considering the fact that I admired Dana Carvey so much when he was on SNL, it was doubly sad for me. So
well, now we're going to segue into what we learned. I think we pretty much exhausted what we gleaned from this train wreck. But I could also add, because this is, I'm nitpicking here, admittedly, but my God, if I have to hear fucking Walking on Sunshine in a montage again, like, Jesus. Like, it's just every fucking rom-com has that song in it. I can't take it. I just can't. No more. No more Walking on Sunshine.
I don't think that will ever be retired in the filmmaker's toolbox for me ever. You know,
it's true.
For time immemorial, you'll be walking on sunshine. And don't it feel good?
No, this thing doesn't feel good. Should we go to what you learned?
Well, you know, I don't know, because it's interesting, because I think what I learned is what makes things funny. Because as we were going on, you know, this is one of the things I really like about the way we do our podcast.
Yeah, it's tangential.
I'm not going to be all self-aggrandizing, but I mean, you know, we don't think, we don't write, we don't plan, we just talk, you know?
Yeah.
And as we talked, I mean, I started to really sort of get a sense of what makes things funny and what makes things unfunny. And I've learned now why I find certain things funny and why I find things unfunny. And so I thank you for this discussion. Star rating, do we even have to go there?
Yeah, one for me. Mm-hmm. Like, I was physically in pain at times. And we did fast forward through some of this. We just couldn't take it.
Yeah.
And which is interesting, because I never made this demand of you of Battlefield Earth to say, like, I can't take anymore, please fast forward it, which was awful, and the tone was off, and the thing was rife with problems of all sorts that we delved into in our Battlefield Earth podcast, and yet we defended it. This thing, it was unbearable, and I could see why this sunk Carvey significantly, as Love Guru did Myers, and it's kind of a shame. And I'd like to see them both work in their area of expertise again.
Man, I mean,
maybe pair them up again. What the hell?
They reboot everything. Why not? Yeah. Miserable 3.
Why not? You could have them tour Japan. They could do a Spinal Tap kind of thing.
They could really end and an aged Wayne's World. That'd be kind of funny. That would be a good idea to see. Have a couple, you know.
Because it's interesting.
50-something Waynes and Garths? Yeah.
I was at the dentist yesterday, and there was a guy talking to the receptionist about a rock and roll cruise that he went on.
Oh, was it the ill-fated Def Leppard cruise?
No, but it was it was something comparable. I think it would take you down to, it was via Miami down to maybe St. Thomas or Trinidad and Tobago or God knows what, somewhere in the Caribbean, and some of the people involved were like Steve Perry from Journey, Burton Cummings from The Guess Who, like all these has-been rockers have now, instead of turning to Japan to elongate their careers, they are doing the cruise ship circuit, which is so sad. Because when you want to take it all back to comedy now, there's nothing sadder than a cruise ship comedian. That is really the lowest you can go as a working stand-up. Like, forget the Chuckle Hut and whatever, Idaho, right? Like, there's at least some respectability that goes along with a stand-up comic going to a far-flung comedy club somewhere in the Midwest and just killing it in front of 100 people who don't get to see comedy much. There's something cool about that, like an indie band. You go do it. Cruise ship just sucks the comedy out of everything. There's something just terrible about it, and I don't know.
Well,
You know what, man? Just to wrap this up, I'm going to say one thing. I mean, I think we're going to probably lay off comedy for a little while on the Really Awful Movies podcast. However, down the road, you know, maybe a few months from now, once I recover from this debacle, Freddy got fingered.
Definitely. I've always wanted to
see it. I've always wanted to see that as well.
Yeah. We are going to do...
Daddy, would you like some sausage?
It is. Yeah. We love Freddy's fingers, but we are going to get Freddy fingered on the podcast for sure. And if that makes any sense. And for more, check out Really Awful Movies. We cover a wide range of genre films on our website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. We don't do comedy on that, but we save that for the podcast. But we do sci-fi, action, predominantly horror. Follow us, awful_movies. And, of course, check out our podcast every week, a different genre film every week.
And buy our book while you're at it, too.
Yeah, our fantastic new book, Death by Umbrella. And we will talk to you very soon.
Take care. Thank you.